We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
There's a place where the gold runs deep. And when you strike big. Meet Nevada's fastest growing mineral claim holder in the heart of elephant country. Visit NevadaKing.ca to follow the story.
Welcome back to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bojvics. Joining me today is Dave Kranzler from InvestmentResearchDynamics.com, the author of the Mining Stock Journal and Short Sellers Journal. How are you today, Dave?
Doing well, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you back. So I want, maybe let's start by having you tell us about the significance of the options expiration and what the typical behavior of the gold price is around it.
Sure. Well, the COMEX contract, futures contracts have options that you can, you know, put some calls that investors use for speculative purposes or whatever. Some investors may have intent to take delivery of the underlying contract. They just kind of function like options on anything else. And typically, so the market makers on the COMEX, primarily the bullion banks, are going to be the ones who write the options. Right. So they go short calls and puts, and especially it's usually not that significant when you have delivery months that are not the major delivery months. I mean, I still have no idea how what's known as the front month contracts were ever became known as the front month contracts. It may go back to the days when futures were primarily associated with agricultural products. I don't know. I've always meant to kind of research that. But at any rate, what happens is when you have the large delivery months like December and February, for instance, you also get a big buildup at various strike levels of open interest for calls. And, there's because investors tend to usually use options more for bullish speculative purposes, there's going to be a lot more calls, open interest in calls, than there will be in puts. And so what happens is you'll get like a big cluster of open call interest around, you know, kind of round strike price level. So for instance, for December, there was a massive amount of open call options at 1900. There also happened to have been, a reasonable amount of open calls, you know, below 1900. And so what happens is if the futures price closes below, let's just say for sake of ease, you know, sake of discussion, you know, the futures price closes below 1900, when you write the call option, the option expires worthless, right? Because it's out of the money. And the entity that writes the call gets to keep the premium that it collected from writing the option. And so what happens is, and it's not like a one-off thing where it maybe happens every once in a while. It's repetitive. It's every large contract delivery month, especially when there happens to be an inordinate amount of open calls at various strikes. What happens is the price of gold mysteriously gets pushed well below the strike prices where there's a lot of calls open, and the banks reap a ton of profits. I mean, I don't know if you saw the headline, JP Morgan was recently fined, what, $920 million for spoofing activities in the COMEX futures market. Well, as it turns out, in the latest quarter, they made more than that in their gold trading operations. And how do they make money, that kind of money, in their gold trading operations and their silver trading operations? It's from their ability to manipulate the market. So
seems like just the cost of doing business for them.
Right. That's exactly right. These fines are the cost of doing business. And it works out even better if they can, you know, offset the fine they pay from other activities in that, you know, in that business segment. So, and this has been going on for a long time, and pretty much, you know, you hope it doesn't happen, but it just every big delivery contract month, it happens. The price of gold gets taken down, and you know that it's a source of enormous profits for these market making bullion banks on the COMEX. And typically, you know, within a day or two after the options, you know, the options expire, you'll see a rally in the precious metals. So, you know, and so for instance, the takedown that we saw in this last week, you know, gold was taken down, about $100. Very little physical gold actually traded hands. This was all in the paper derivatives market. Now there was some heavy offerings for the last few days in London on the AM and PM fix, especially the PM fix. So that means that, you know, and I'm assuming the selling was coming from the bullion banks to try and help push the price down. It's kind of like the LBMA and the COMEX kind of have a partnership in their efforts to manipulate the price of gold.
And the reason I asked you that, Dave, is because obviously yesterday Tuesday was when the options expiration day was. So right. Could it be, and we've also seen gold get smashed down to about the $1,800 level. So could it be that the manipulation of the gold price by the banks to push the price lower, thereby giving or trying to dissuade anyone from taking deliveries this month? You were also saying that December is a large delivery month, and we've seen a big wall of deliveries coming on the COMEX. So could that be part of it?
Oh, well, and that's, you know, that's also the objective in pushing the price down was twofold. And, you know, again, what when you have, there's also with every contract month, there's the first notice day. And that's the first day that if you're along a COMEX contract, you can be noticed for delivery. So this December first notice day is Monday, December 30th, but technically notices start going out on Friday afternoon. They start going out the afternoon the day before the official first notice date. So I want to say, you know, by mid last week, there was well over 200,000 contracts open. And another objective in pushing down the price, especially when you see these shock and awe, Jim Sinclair used to refer to them as fishing lines, right? The fishing line price action.
The sinkers.
And I mean, if you just go look at a 15-minute chart for the last week of December gold, you'll see it. I mean, it's like all, and usually the fishing lines occur after the AM fix in London, or they'll occur right as the COMEX is opening, you know, boom, all of a sudden out of nowhere, there's no news or events that would have caused someone to dump paper gold in quantities large enough to cause a sell-off like that. All of a sudden there it is, you know, and what's even crazier about it is if you're long COMEX contracts, if you're trying to be a profit maximizer, you're not going to dump contracts like that all at once to try and push the price lower. You're going to try and work slowly out of them. But yeah, for sure, those shock and awe hits are designed to shake out weaker longs who may or may not be thinking about standing for delivery. But that kind of guarantees that they won't if you can get these longs to sell. So there's still. I checked this morning, and I think the open interest as of yesterday was 95,000 contracts, and it's been coming down in 40 to 50,000 chunks for the last 3 or 4 days. So it'll be interesting to see how many contracts will be left standing Well, really, we'll see the numbers on Friday for today. And then we'll have an idea. We'll have some idea what the size of the constituency is that will be standing for delivery for December. So what's interesting, and it's been happening more than I've ever seen it this year, is that in the current contract month, the open interest has actually been rising. It popped last week, and I'm not talking about a lot of contracts, but you know, it popped from like 300 contracts to 1100 contracts. And if you're buying a contract in the current month, right, not the front month, but the current month, that means your intent is to take delivery, because when you buy a contract and you're in the notice period, your account has to be fully funded, because the minute that trade settles, you can get notice for delivery. So I've noticed, and I started watching Ford, I guess, in April. It just seemed like every month there were, you know, the open interest in the current trading month, there would be open interest outstanding all the way until the contract stopped trading. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's just an indication that there's definitely a larger population of investors of all flavors that are looking to take delivery of gold under the terms of the contracts.
Yeah, it's an interesting thought to think about who would be taking delivery of large contracts of gold like that, obviously, like taking it from the COMEX like that, right?
I mean, if you know, you look at the managed account segment, I look at the disaggregated commitment of traders report, because it gives you more information than the ones where you just see commercials and non-commercials all in aggregate. A lot of the deliveries seem to be occurring in what's called the other reportables category. So you got the managed money, the other reportables, and then the non-reportables, which are retail. Mm-hmm. Myself included, a lot of us over the years have tried to email the COMEX and say, who exactly makes up the other reportables? And they give you some pokey answer. I mean, they don't define exactly what it is. Interestingly, JP Morgan got fined, I think it was in 2014, it might have been 2012, for they got caught stuffing trades that belonged in the swap dealer's account into the other reportables account. So they got fined a whopping $650,000. So I'm sure that deterred them from still manipulating their reporting of the various accounts that make up the commitment of traders. But at any rate, I think the other reportables largely would be entities like family offices. It'd be large pools of money that are non-professional money or institutional money management. So mutual funds and hedge funds would be the managed money. I think you're talking about family offices and wealthy individuals would be the primary constituency of the other reportables. I'm sure there's some other entities that get thrown into there. So, and I think that's where a lot of the deliveries are being taken. But I also think it's important to distinguish between a delivery and a delivery. So when delivery occurs on the COMEX and you decide, well, I don't want to deal with the safekeeping, so I'll just leave my bars at the COMEX for safekeeping, I don't consider that a bona fide real delivery, because first of all, there's no way to know if the bars were actually moved from, you know, someone else's allocated account to your allocated account. You know, there's no way to know if that happens. The deliveries that most of the deliveries that you're seeing on the COMEX are basically digital entries. They're electronic. And so, you know, there can be a lot of potential underlying fraud there.
This is actually a point I wanted to get to with you, Dave, is you were mentioning in a recent article that you don't think that the December delivery wall will necessarily break the COMEX, but you do point to the fact that if people started taking their gold out of the COMEX vaults like this, then they can't necessarily borrow against it, right? And that could actually break the COMEX.
That's right. That would break. I'm positive that would break the COMEX. If the entities that have titled interest in bars in the COMEX just said, okay, you know what, I prefer to use my own safekeeping devices for this, and I'm going to move my bars from a COMEX vault to a non-COMEX private vault, or even, I mean, I wouldn't, I don't think, you know, the large owners of gold, I don't think they're going to stick them in a bank safe deposit box. And I wouldn't do that either. I know of some wealthy people who have their own private vault. So, and there's private vaults. There's a few private vaults around the country. Texas has one. And I think there's one in Idaho. There's probably some others that I haven't heard of, but that event in and of itself would break the COMEX, in my opinion. Now, the COMEX incentivizes you to keep your bars there for safekeeping, because once you take delivery, it's cheaper to keep your bars in the COMEX. They charge a lower fee than it would cost at a non-COMEX private depository. So. It's also, we actually, in my fund back in, I think it was 2009, took delivery of silver, and we weren't taking delivery of a lot of silver bars, but it took us 6 weeks longer than it was supposed to for us to get to, in order for us to be able to have our Brinks guy go up to the COMEX vault. It was HSBC was the counterparty, and get our silver bars out of it. And there's fees that you have to pay to load out bars. It's called loading out the bars. So the COMEX has it set up to disincentivize removal of the bars from the vaults. And they incentivize you to keep the bars in there because it's cheaper to keep them there than it is. Would have been cheaper for us to keep our bars there than in the depository where we keep them.
And their main motivation for that would be basically that they're lending against them, correct?
They're hypothecating the bars, and who knows, a lot of those bars may be, they may be, have been electronically delivered to several entities, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you just don't know until you actually go and say, okay, I want my gold. And so I want the bars with the serial numbers on the receipt that I received when I went through the delivery process.
Mm-hmm. So is there any way to, do they have any rules around what the actual, let's call it, reserve requirements are for the COMEX? Like in a fractional reserve banking scenario, you have, you know, a certain percentage of quote unquote money that's supposed to be in reserve that's lended against. So are there any of the same types of percentage rules that apply to the COMEX bars?
What do you mean in terms of
that? As you're saying, they can rehypothecate them like so many number of times. Is there any type of the same ruling around?
They're not supposed to be hypothecating these bars. I mean, if you take delivery of a bar, do you want them to lend it out on your behalf?
Absolutely not.
Right. Exactly. So, I haven't gone through the COMEX contract with a fine tooth comb, but here's the thing. And you can't prove, we won't be able to prove it until, you know, the COMEX collapses or the LBMA collapses, but there's not really supposed to be a fractional bullion system. Mm-hmm. I mean, banks and central banks lease out their bars. And so what I'm saying is it's quite possible the COMEX may be leasing out bars that have been delivered without telling the owner of the bars that they're being delivered. I mean, if the banks are operating their COMEX business segment honestly and ethically, it'd be the only business line at any big bank that's being run honestly and ethically.
That's a great
And how do we know that? Because these banks are getting, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of fines over the last few years for transgressions in a lot of their other business lines.
So, as you're saying that these banks are really not operating honestly. And I saw your tweet to Craig Hemke the other day, as you're mentioning that sharp drop in the gold price, nothing fishy here, right? So we got a lot of questions the last time I had you on about how this manipulation actually works and who benefits from it. So maybe if we could quickly kind of go through how it works and who benefits from it mostly.
So just in terms of the manipulation itself, well, I mean, again, you know, a lot of outside observers might say, oh, what you guys are talking about is conspiracy theory. And, you know, prove that there's been manipulation. Well, there's been enough people, and I've been involved in the sector for 20 years, and it was being discussed. It was really Gatta who kind of brought it to the public's attention. Not that many people in the public care about the precious metal sector or paying attention to it, but the people that do care about it and who have studied this, there's repeated patterns that have been going on for the 20 years that I've been doing this. And so, unfortunately, the banks, the market makers on the COMEX, the CFTC allows the open interest in COMEX gold contracts. I'll just call it paper gold. To the open interest in those contracts to be anywhere from, you know, 5 and sometimes as high as 10 times the notional value of the value of the underlying bars that are available for delivery, right? And so that in and of itself makes the COMEX not a legitimate price discovery mechanism, because COMEX contracts are totally, the trading and buying and selling of COMEX contracts have been totally dislocated from the actual business of buying and selling physical gold and silver, right? And you know, if you think about what the purpose of futures contracts were originally, you know, I think they started trading futures maybe in the 1700s, and it allowed farmers to finance their crop, right? So you would go and say in March or February or whatever, you'd go and you'd sell futures contracts on part of your crop that you're getting ready to plant. And that would let you finance planting it and nurturing it until it, you know, was harvested. And then you would have to deliver the amount of the crop that you had contracted for on the futures basis for delivery, and you keep the rest, and that's your profit, right? Well, the futures market in gold and silver don't work that way. I mean, if everyone who was long a futures contract a week ago stood for delivery, and they removed the bars from the COMEX, that would break the COMEX, mm-hmm. right? Because you're talking over 200,000 contracts. It's 20 million ounces. And I haven't looked at the warehouse stocks recently, but I'm sure there's not 20 million ounces of gold that's registered for delivery. So it essentially removes supply and demand economics from the price discovery process of futures. So what happens is that when the price of gold starts moving higher, these banks short into that, and they keep shorting it, and they keep shorting it. And it has nothing to do with the actual supply and demand for the underlying physical gold. This is just, you know, trading paper the way Robinhood traders trade the stock of bankrupt companies, right? They're just chasing momentum higher. And the banks are breaking that momentum by feeding contracts in there. So then, and again, there's not a magic number, but what happens is that the banks kind of know where the stop losses are, right? You're a hedge fund and you're speculating on, you know, the price of gold going higher. So you're going to keep going long and you're going to put in trailing stops, right? And make no mistake, the banks have access to that data because the banks run, you know, they control the trading systems on the COMEX. And so what happens is, especially when you get into what's the first notice, the roll is called the roll period, just informally. And that's usually starts about 2 weeks before first notice day, where these hedge funds will, none of them are going to stand for delivery. So what they end up doing is they sell the front month and move out to the next front month. So if you notice in today's open interest report, you had something like 52,000 contracts. And these are just ballpark numbers from memory. 52,000 contracts that came off of December and 43,000 contracts that were added to the February open interest. And that's the hedge funds rolling. Well, it makes it easier to push the price down when you know you've got a whole contingency of hedge funds that are going to be selling December. And even though they're swapping into February, it still puts downward pressure on the price because the banks help that along. What they'll do is they'll just start going out and dumping more paper onto the market, and they trigger these stop losses that are, and they, again, this is all going on in you know, the black boxes. It's automatic when, you know, the way this, the algorithmic trading works now. And what happens is the hedge funds start dumping paper, and all of a sudden that's when you get these fishing line formations, and that's what happens. And so ideally what the banks are trying to do is, you know, so let's say, you know, gold, what, 2 weeks ago was at 1850 and it ran up to almost 1950. If they're shorting paper the whole way up, the average cost of their short entry is probably going to be 1900 or over. And so if they can push the price down below 1900 and cover and use the selling from the hedge funds to cover the December contract, they're going to make a lot of money. And that's how JP Morgan, between that and keeping the call option premium that it collects, when the big chunks of call options expire worthless, that's how they make their money, manipulating the market. And the purpose of manipulating the market is let's say the market wasn't manipulated. Where do you think the price of gold would be? What if, as it is with every other frickin' commodity sector on the CME, what if the CFTC said, okay, there can't be more than 110% notional value outstanding of the underlying amount of gold and silver that is available for delivery. So what you're talking about here is that when a hedge, once you get to 110% or say even 120%, I think the CFTC allows it to go up to 120%. And I don't have a problem with that because it helps the liquidity of the market. But what happens if the open interest in contracts is 120% of the underlying amount of gold and the hedge funds keep buying this stuff? Well, the banks can't just print up more contracts and feed them into the market, right? Because the open interest has to stay set at 120% of the underlying. That's where then you're going to have to find a seller. That's how trading is supposed to work. When I was a junk bond trader, you know, I would short liquid issues to make markets. But if there's an illiquid issue and an account wanted to come in and buy bonds of that company, I would have to tell my sales force, we got to go out and find a seller. And if you don't have a seller at this price, tell me what price they'll sell at. Mm-hmm. See what I'm saying? Is that clear? Like what the difference is between
you're missing out on and what's, yeah, you're missing out on real price discovery. And
exactly.
It also brings to mind the let's say shakiness of the, you know, the dollar for gold trade. It's if gold started going much, much higher, you know, if it had proper price discovery, then people would maybe lose their want to have so many US dollars, right?
I think that's exactly the reason why, and it's the banks just act as agents for the central banks. But that's exactly why the banks are allowed to manipulate the market. It's why the central banks, the Western central banks specifically, want to keep a lid on the price of gold as much as possible. And that's to protect, you know, it's to protect the perception of the US dollar. And it's interesting because several years ago, there were letters that had been declassified by the government. And I'm surprised they even did this. But there's like communications between Henry Kissinger and some of his financial advisors when he was Secretary of State. And they knew that, you know, because this was just after we had gone off the gold standard. In fact, gold futures didn't even exist until 1974. And there's communications and GATA in their archives has these letters. So you can actually look at them. I'm not making this up. It's not conspiracy theory. It's there in plain black and white. But in these letters, they discuss the need to try and funnel institutional money away from physical gold and into an alternative form of gold. And that's how gold futures were developed. So, you know, it's similar with GLD, because GLD isn't really a physical gold fund per se. I mean, I have not read of anyone who's been allowed to exchange their GLD shares for bars to remove them from GLD. And that is to act as kind of a drain catch for all the money that would otherwise might buy physical gold and safekeep it somewhere. You know, let's let them funnel their money into a paper asset, a paper form of gold, and make them think that they're buying gold or getting exposure to gold. So again, it's not like this is conspiracy theory that people have been making up. There's you know, it's one of these things where if it looks like a duck, walks like a duck, and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. And that's what the precious metals manipulation is.
Perfect. So as we're talking about all the manipulation and everything, the next question does seem kind of weird. If prices are that manipulated, but do you think that the next round of money printing is one of the biggest factors that we need right now to push gold past that magical $2,000 mark and maybe get silver back up over 30?
Well, that's a great question. And you know, again, there's the manipulation that we're seeing in the last couple of weeks the primary purpose was for the banks to make a lot of money and to try and get the open interest down as much as possible ahead of first notice. But it's also, and you can go back and study the charts on gold and silver, you know, go back to March 2008. And what happens is, and this is like clockwork. Every time the Fed is preparing to announce more money printing, you know, a couple months ahead of that or a month ahead of that, all of a sudden the price of gold mysteriously gets taken down hard and fast. We saw that in March. Mm-hmm. Now, to be sure, some of the sell-off in paper gold was related to the sell-off in the stock market, but it was also served the purpose of getting the price of gold as low as possible ahead of that massive money printing announcement that I think it was March 15th, I think, or March 17th. It was a Sunday night when the Fed announced that, and boom, gold goes up. I think it was up at one point overnight, over $100, but it's better for them to have gold. And I think gold got pushed down to 1300 or 1400 back then. It's better for them to have that launching point at a much lower price point, right? Mm-hmm. Than if they were just say, oh, let's just let gold do what it may, and then we'll make the announcement. Because then, you know, I can't remember where gold was trading, say, in early February back then. I think I have a chart in front of me. You know, As you mentioned there, that's part of the purpose is to get the price down ahead of a big money printing announcement. If you look in 2008, the price of gold was taken down from, in March it was, I think it hit 1200. And by late October, it was all the way down to 700. Right. And then, it started rallying, and that was right around the time when they started the bailouts of the banks and that $800 billion taxpayer funded facility plus the what they called quantitative easing, but it's really just money printing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think we're going to get another round of money printing. It might happen before the end of the year, but certainly after Biden is inaugurated, we'll see more, a lot more money printing. Three or four different big banks have come out in the last week and said, we need more QE. They don't call it money printing, but that's politically incorrect. But so that to me tells me we got another big round of money printing coming. And, it's just a matter of how soon it's announced. So, yeah, getting the price of gold down, you know, when they make that announcement, they'd much rather have the price of gold below 1900 than over 2000, which is where it was headed, probably a month ago before this sell-off took hold.
Interesting. So it could be almost a signaling mechanism to say that there's more money printing coming.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't even know that's necessarily a signaling mechanism. I think they just...
Indirect signaling mechanism, let's say.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
So how does this play into the interest in the junior miners?
Well, I mean, as it is, before this latest sell-off in the sector, the miners are relative to where the price of gold and silver are right now. The miners are cheaper now than they have been at any time in the last 20 years. So if you look at just the Huey Index, for example, when the price of gold was at 1900 in September of 2011, the Huey Index peaked at something like 650. Right. So you would think that with the price of gold at 1900 again, the Huey would be up at 650. Well, no, I don't remember where it topped out, but it's at 279 right now. It might have gotten up to like 330 or something. So relative to where the mining stocks were trading, and I'm just using the Huey generically, where they were trading back in February 2011 with gold getting ready to make its run to 1900. They're 50% cheaper, right? Mm-hmm. Gold at the same price range.
I wonder if you did an inflation adjusted price of gold and had a correlating point for the Huey on, let's say, an inflation adjusted price of gold, if you'd have any correlation there.
What do you mean? Like,
if let's say you adjusted for the rate of inflation over the years since the Huey was last at 650, as you're saying,
I see what you're saying.
If you'd have a correlation, but you're saying, well,
I don't know that should affect it, because relative to, so the Huey is it's gold producers, mining companies that are producing gold, and between 2011, the sell-off or the short-term bear market we had in the sector that went from 2011 to the end of 2015. In that time period, all of these producers drastically cut their cost structure. Mm-hmm. And they're producing a lot more efficiently now. Their operations are run a lot more efficiently, which means that for every ounce of gold that they're selling, they're taking more to the bottom line now than they would have been in 2011. So you would think that with gold at 1900, you would think that the Huey Index should be trading at least the level where it was back in 2011 and possibly even higher. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, that's a great point.
And the juniors, to me, the juniors are really something in my opinion, you can't really analyze the juniors. And I'm talking about, I'm not talking about the companies that are called juniors and put into the GDXJ index, right? Those companies, I think the average market cap for those companies is like $1 billion or $800 million. To me, if you're producing and you've got $1 billion market cap, you're not really a junior anymore. You're a producer. You're a mid cap or a large cap. So when I'm talking about juniors, I'm talking about the mining companies that are exploring for a deposit. They have a property and they're drilling on it and they're trying to develop an economic deposit. And I call them the venture capital juniors. So, and typically the market cap's going to be under 100 million, but you know, it's not a hard and fast rule. I mean, there's some juniors that I cover in my mining stock journal that have $700-800 million market caps. But at any rate, a lot of these juniors are the ones that, and you got to look at the juniors kind of on a cherry picked basis, case by case basis, because they're all different. And most of them will end up never having a project that will convert into a mine. But, you know, a fair percentage of them will. And as the price of gold goes higher, you're going to get more of these juniors that actually are able to convert their property into mine, because you're going to have smaller resources that are lower grade all of a sudden become economical at $2,000 gold versus $1,000 gold. So I had thought that the juniors had gotten a little bit frothy and had outrun where they should have been trading over the summer. And I had tweets that mentioned this, but I also was discussing it in my mining stock journal. I was like, look, at some point, I don't know when, there's going to be a correction here because there's just too much frothiness in this market. And then all the indications of a overheated market were there. So lo and behold, there's, you know, I've got stocks that have dropped 50% from where they were trading at the end of July or in mid August. And the ones that I think are likely going to end up having projects that convert into mines, those are the ones that I think, you know, people should be buying right now.
So are some of those including, takeover targets from majors?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The thing about these junior explorers is the majors kind of, they can look at them as either future inventory of resource or they're basically options, right? You know, especially the ones that have, there's several that have, that are probably, you know, say within 12 months of actually converting their project into a mine, and strategic investors, major mining companies have, you know, 10, 20% interest in the stocks of these companies, right? So you could say that theoretically they're holding an in the money call option, right? If you own 20% of a company and it looks like it's going to convert to a mine, it's got 1 million ounces of gold and it's good grade, you know, that's an in the money call option. So, you know, and theoretically, you never exercise an in the money call option until you have to. So, and I think that's what we're seeing a lot of these. I think that's a lot of what's going on right now. It seems like in the first 10 years of this bull market, you know, say from 2000, well, I got started in 2001. So 2001 to 2011, just based on my observation, it feels like there were more takeovers of juniors back then than we're seeing right now. And I think that's because what happens is these large cap companies, instead of spending a ton of money on a lot of different juniors, they're waiting until the last minute before they actually have to make the decision to buy the company. Mm-hmm. And I think they're kind of treating the juniors now more as in the money call options, as opposed to actually going out and buying them. But certainly, a lot of these juniors that have highly prospective projects that look like they're going to advance towards production, eventually they're going to get taken over.
So are there any specific factors that you look at, Dave, when you're thinking about trying to invest in a takeover target?
I don't invest in a junior mining stock specifically because I think it's going to get taken over. I invest in a junior mining stock because I see something that basically is offering me, you know, a 3 to 5 times upside reward versus 50% downside risk. And ideally, you're going to get, you know, the 3 to 5 upside before a large cap company actually steps in and decides to take the company, you know, the junior over. I mean, it used to drive me nuts, you know, especially in the pre-2011 era, where you would do all your homework, you'd invest in a company, you know, do it, you know, had all your ducks in a row, dotted your I's, crossed your T's, and the stock would double and then boom, it would get taken over. And it'd just be like, oh, please don't let that happen, because you know there's a lot of potential upside that's being left on the table. So honestly, my hope is when I decide to get involved in a company's stock, I hope that they don't get taken over until, you know, they're breaking ground on construction, because that's where shareholder value is maximized for the early investors and the juniors.
Excellent. So, Dave, before I let you go, I want to talk a little bit about the economy. You were saying that it's much weaker than it would appear from the stimulus-juiced economic reports that have emerged over the summer. So auto new home sales are already starting to roll over. Which two factors have set up the potential for breathtaking market sell-off sometime in the next 3 to 6 months, as you were talking about?
That's a good question, because I would argue that the only reason the stock market is where it is because of all the money that the Fed has printed since March. I think probably what's going to happen is that the tech sector, especially a lot of these crazy, insanely overvalued Silicon unicorn type companies, or, you know, the electric vehicle, the stocks of the EVs, electric vehicle manufacturers that are just, I mean, insanely overvalued. I think what's going to happen is out of nowhere, you're going to start to see a big sell-off in the tech sector. That's how it happened in early 2000, right? No one has been, to this day, I haven't seen anyone identify a specific cause for why the NASDAQ all of a sudden crashed. It just happened. And I think it's just sort of a collective. I think what happens is that the market runs out of, you know, the next fool is going to come along and pay more for the stocks that the speculators have bought the day before. And I think what happens is it's just, there's an inertia there that causes everyone to start selling at once. And I think that's probably what'll happen this time around, is that you'll see a big crash in the tech sector. And then that'll, you know, like it did in 2000, over a period of time, it'll bleed into the general stock market. That's what I think will happen. But, you know, who knows?
Excellent, Dave. So we can find more about all your writing and everything at investmentresearchdynamics.com. We can find the Mining Stock Journal and the Short Sellers Journal there as well, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Perfect. All right, Dave, thanks very much for your time today.
Thanks, Tom. Good talking with you.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.